bring them back to Seattle. Those two kind of families.
Oh, no, where?
In Winona. Moving their stuff to Mexico. Making record profits and then still having to lay off America.
This is too
so we'll make more profits in Mexico. So, you know, people are just trying to get and kick my teeth.
Oh, yeah,
our bridge when it was closed suddenly for a while. So it's like, man, Tony just keeps going on and on.
This meeting of the Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. We've called this hearing because we're very concerned about the fact that the federal government is changing considerably the way in which they renew a waiver that Minnesota Care has received in the past that has allowed us to cover many of the parents along with the children that are in our program. And we wanted to hear more about it today. And so we have invited folks from the Department of Human Services to explain the situation to us and let us know where they're at with it. And on my agenda today, I have Ann Berg is going to do the presenting. Welcome.
Madam Chair, hi, I'm Ann Berg, the Deputy Medicaid Director. I work for Christine Bronson, who is the Deputy Commissioner and Medicaid Director at the Department of Human Services. Christine sends her apologies. She couldn't be here today. She is actually in Washington negotiating with CMS officials on this very issue.
And we originally thought that the deadline would be the 12th, which was last week. And we have been given two more weeks from the 12th by CMS to continue this process of negotiation. So we may not know today what the outcome will be, but I still think it's important for you all to be informed about the serious nature of the changes that are being proposed by CMS and the big impact it will have potentially. Loss of coverage for 17,000 parents in the program unless we can figure out a way to get along without this federal money. So why don't you tell us about, you know, when the waiver was up for renewal, and this is a waiver that we've had for how long, and why this is quite a surprise to us. Why don't you just fill us in on all of that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Minnesota Care waiver, well, it's officially known as the PMAP Plus waiver, and that has to do with the history of the waiver. It's existed since about 1995. Its original purpose was to both give us the authority to do the PMAP program, mandatory enrollment in managed care, and in addition, it gave us federal Medicaid matching funds on the children in Minnesota Care. It was later expanded to add federal match for parents and pregnant women, I think, in Minnesota Care. It's existed for a long time. It's currently on a three-year cycle. It was last negotiated in 2005. It was set to expire this year on July 1st. We worked through three different two-week extensions after July 1st, and then on August 11th, they issued the letter that Senator Berglund was referring to.
Why don't you tell us what the letter said?
Sure. The August 11th, well, to give a little more background, the waiver, the renewal was submitted back in December. According to the federal requirements, you have to submit it 6 months prior to its expiration. A lot of the work that CMS was doing between the time of receipt of that renewal and about May was technical in nature. What they were doing is taking the old protocol and the waiver terms and conditions and consolidating them. It wasn't a substantive discussion. It was language moving around, but really the status quo. So it wasn't until about May of this year where CMS started talking to us about substantive issues. And then in May and June, three major issues really sort of emerged. One was budget neutrality, which has to do with the terms and conditions of federal waivers, CMS will, their policy is to not issue a Section 1115 waiver or demonstration project waiver unless the, your proposal, the state's proposal is budget neutral to the federal government. The way they express budget neutrality is to cap the populations, put a per capita cap on the populations that are covered by your waiver. Our caps were negotiated in 2005. They're 3 years old. They're all based on estimates done in 2004 of what we would be spending per person in Minnesota Care or in the Medicaid eligible groups in Minnesota Care back in 2005. Things have changed since those estimates. Taking our current caps and trending them forward against the federal inflation rate leaves us actually very little margin over the next 3 years in terms of what we call room under budget neutrality. So that was a major issue in May and June, and it's still an open issue now. The second issue that emerged late in the game was the carve-out from the capitation rates in medical assistance that gets carved out from the capitation rates, transferred to the Department of Health Medical Education and Research Trust Fund, and then transferred out to medical education providers from that trust fund. What CMS is saying now is that the way we do that is not appropriately limited according to their understanding of the regulations. We disagree with that position, but what they appear to be, what they're saying to us is that that carve-out has to be subject to some annual aggregate limit. And what's going on now is a lot of data sharing and trying to figure out where they're going to land in terms of what that limit will be. The third major issue has to do with the parents. That issue has to do, well, in Minnesota Care, we have Medicaid authority to cover parents from zero to with income between 0 to 200% of poverty under Medicaid. And that authority pre-exists the SCHIP program. When the SCHIP program was enacted by Congress, Minnesota was one of those states that was locked out of SCHIP funding because we had a high Medicaid income standard to start with. I think in the year 2000, we negotiated the SCHIP waiver, which gives us the authority to take some of the existing expenditures in Minnesota Care for parents and claim those as SCHIP expenditures to the extent of the SCHIP allotment. That gives us a 65% federal match as opposed to a 50% federal match for that group of parents. We also have two other SCHIP, what we call state plan groups. They don't require waivers. Those are the pregnant women who are not otherwise eligible for medical assistance or any federal program, and those that small group of children with income between, in MA, with income between 275 and 280% of poverty. Those groups, their expenditures don't come close to our SCHIP allotment, and so we have to claim them, those two groups of children, we have to claim them all year long. And then what we have done, or the way we forecast those SCHIP funds, is we take the remaining amount of the allotment and we calculate the amount of expenditures against those Minnesota Care parents between 1 and 200% of poverty, claim those to SCHIP to the extent there's money available, and then revert them to Medicaid at that point in time when SCHIP funds are no longer available. That winds up having us estimate what point in the year that happens, where if we claim those children all year long, what month in the year would we convert those parents from SCHIP to Medicaid. CMS is now saying that violates their policy, and that we actually have to run the SCHIP allotment down to zero at some point in the year in order to convert those parents to Medicaid. On August 11th, we were expecting CMS. We had asked for another two-week extension to work out ways to avoid that problem. And that's when they issued, instead of issuing another two-week extension, they issued new terms and conditions that were essentially unfavorable. It did three things. It hardwired the budget neutrality problem. It hardwired the old caps at the federal trend rate. It hardwired an aggregate cap on medical education at 2007 levels, which results in a cut to the current year. And then it basically said, you do not have authority under this waiver, under these terms and conditions, to claim Medicaid for that group of parents between 100 and 200% of poverty. So they're basically saying you can use SCHIP funds for that group, but when you run out, Minnesota's on your own for that particular population. And that's what creates the hole in the Minnesota Care Program. You have no federal matching funds once for those adults once that SCHIP allotment is used up.
And each one of these things would have an impact in terms of how much dollars.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. We calculated that the sum total of the two cuts, the GME and the Medicaid eligibility, was about $135.4 million over 3 years in loss of federal matching funds. It would affect Medicaid eligibility for about 18,000 people. I also forgot to mention there's another change in those surprise terms and conditions that redefines what a parent is in Minnesota Care to only include parents of children under the age of 19 as opposed to what we currently do, which is 21. They have said subsequently that was a mistake and that they'll correct it, and we're working on getting that corrected. But that's about 1,000 parents a year as well.
And what is, if we don't accept the new terms of the waiver and didn't have the waiver at all, what is that worth?
Madam Chair, members, I don't think George Hoffman is here today, but I recall that the full value of FFP in Minnesota Care is about $100 million.
Per year,
yeah.
So it'd be $200 million for the biennium.
Correct.
And we've been given 2 weeks more from the September 12th date to continue negotiating with the federal government on this issue?
That's correct, Madam Chair. We have till, I believe it's next Wednesday, is the next looming deadline.
Are there other questions?
Question, what is
Senator Coring?
CMS.
Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Other questions? Senator Sharon?
Thank you, Senator Berglund. The loss, if we do not accept the terms of the new waiver terms, is around $200 million for the biennium. That's quite a consequence. Can you tell me, maybe Senator Berglund, you could answer this as well, do we get anything by not participating in the waiver? Is there any advantage to us that we should be thinking about at all?
The only thing that I can think of that could be done is, a certain amount of parents that are eligible for Minnesota Care also are eligible for Medicaid straight out. Without a waiver or anything. So you could try and find a way to finance those parents out of the general fund. I suppose you could change the eligibility for the Medicaid program, try to pick up parents that today are not eligible for the program. But all of this takes time. And my understanding of the last letter that we got was that if we don't accept the new terms and conditions, the waiver expired on August 11th. And so actually, any money that we had spent since then, every day things continue to be processed over DHS and people are eligible, and their claims are being paid. So, you know, I suppose technically CMS could come back and retroactively claim that we owe them money for implementing during that period of time waiver conditions that were no longer in effect. So, you know, it would take time. I mean, eligibility changes need to be done by the legislature. Trying to convert parents from one program to another would take time at the county level and the state level. And so it would be quite disruptive. The whole thing would be quite disruptive.
Senator Berglund, and it would take money out of the general fund. We'd be trying to fund this shortfall out of the Minnesota, just based on Minnesota resources. Is that correct?
Well, the Medicaid program does have a 50% federal match.
So we lose that 15%.
I mean, the idea, I guess, would be we'd be trying to salvage some federal match. But, of course, the SCHIP federal match is at a higher level.
5%. That's 15%.
So,
sorry, for one more follow-up question.
But it's not for the whole year, so I don't know. Maybe the two things can come out in the wash.
It's 100% right.
Somebody would have to look at it.
One final question. As I'm listening, I'm not hearing an advantage yet, so I'm still thinking. I'm still thinking, you know.
Definitely on defense there, yes.
That getting free sometimes of federal regulation gives us something, some flexibility or something that you might want, but you're not able to think of anything that it would be even close to a positive outcome from getting free of this waiver.
Well, and the impact on medical education, you know, those medical education slots are primarily in rural training sites and help us to keep our workforce continuing to be rolled out. And we really don't have any state money left in that program. It's all federal money. So
Senator Berglund, I'm sorry, I said one more, but I was lying. The other thing that strikes me about this is that's frustrating is that we're talking about as if there's something to really think about here in terms of the advantages or the limitations. It's all losses if we don't agree. So I don't.
Well, it's losses if we do agree as well.
Right.
Yes, under any circumstances, it's just trying to minimize what it is that we're going to have to deal with. But I don't know, other than learning about it or knowing what's happening here, what we can do to really have an impact on this.
Well, it seems to me that this is not something that should be happening in the dark of the night in Washington, D.C., that will have that much of a profound impact on citizens of Minnesota. And it seems to me that we should be calling on our federal delegation to put a great deal of pressure to get this changed. And it seems to me that part of creating that pressure is creating public education about the issue. And so I hope you know more already than you did before you got here, and I hope that you feel like you should be calling on people to be doing what they can to get this changed.
Including writing letters to our legislators, which I've already done. I'm hoping everybody else does that as well.
There has been legislation introduced as well to continue our waiver at the current, in the current form that it's in until next year sometime. Yes, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just as a follow-up to Senator Sharon's line of questioning, it seems to me that this is pretty ironic that we're even sitting here having this discussion today, because I know members of this committee particularly remember that it wasn't that long ago. In fact, it was about a year ago that we spent months, in fact, our entire summer and fall, talking about access talking about what do we do to make sure to increase the number of Minnesotans that have health coverage and that are insured and that are provided service. That was just 12 months ago. And today we sit here, and as a result of decisions that are being made in Washington that are, in essence, pulling the rug right out from under us, that's what we need Minnesotans to understand, if nothing else. That's why we're here today.
Other questions?
Madam Chair, you mentioned something that I was going to mention. Has this committee or has the administration been in touch with our congressional delegation? And if so or if not, should this committee be sending, as a committee, be sending a letter to reach out to them to ask for their help to put some?
I personally did send a letter because it didn't appear to me we were going to be able to have this hearing before the deadline of September 12th. Mm-hmm. And so I have sent a letter, and we have been in communication with them. And, of course, this was all happening when many of them were not in Washington because the national conventions were taking place. So that wasn't too helpful either. But, the kind of the message that we were getting at that point in time was, the officials at CMS really don't care what we as a delegation think about this. And so
CMS,
you could call it a parting shot or something like that. I mean, they're not going to be in charge that much longer even to be kind of making this dramatic change in a waiver that Minnesota's had since 1995. But
The bureaucrats at CMS don't care what elected people think? Or
I'm sure that's not a surprise to you.
Not a surprise to me.
Certainly isn't the way it should be in a democracy, that's for sure. Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think you're getting at clarifying the question that I had. And my question was, where are all these terms and conditions coming from? Are they department processes that are being put out there, or is this as a result of a federal bill and legislation direction that's gone out to CMS?
There's no federal law in regard to this. To me, it seems pretty arbitrary that they could conceivably negotiate with another state completely different terms and conditions of a waiver, because it's not really based on law. It's based on the way they see it. And, if you sort of step back from it for a minute and think about it, essentially, if they treat a number of other states like they are treating Minnesota in this case, essentially what they're doing with the federally authorized SCHIP program is creating an additional FMAP program for some states that other states don't really get access to, because that would be the effect of it, really. Some states for some of their population get a 65% match, and other states don't. And that's not what was intended by Congress when they created the SCHIP program, I don't believe.
Well, to follow up, Senator Berglund, thank you. Your explanation is great, but it makes this whole problem makes even less sense now. And I understand the way you're explaining it, but if CMS is treating states individually differently and applying different terms and conditions and rules to the states and the families in need in those states, I mean, there's no consistent approach or process, it seems to me.
Well, they may feel they have some consistent policy they're trying to implement, even though it's not written down or it's not been passed in law or anything. But the fact that it hasn't been debated publicly or passed in law makes it quite mysterious to those of us on the other end of it. And it does seem like a very peculiar time to me to start implementing some new policy that they might have internally when we're, you know, very close to having a federal election and a new administration. Mm-hmm. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, thank you. And this question is perhaps to Ms. Berg, and I apologize if it's not one that you can answer, but perhaps there's someone that could answer this in the room. This is potentially impacts a lot of Minnesotans across the state, and I wonder if the governor has communicated on this issue.
Well, I actually was just handed a letter. It's an answer to Senator Pogemiller, because Senator Pogemiller had written to the governor asking him to get involved in this. Mm-hmm. And the letter is indicating that the governor will be personally meeting with Secretary Leavitt today on this issue. So,
Madam Chair, if I could add that the governor's office has been involved helping us for many months, helping us brief our delegation members, helping set up meetings with the higher level officials at CMS, so very much involved.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could, I received a copy of the letter that Senator Pogemiller sent to the governor, and I was very appreciative of the fact that the majority leader took notice and it weighed in on this issue and is trying to work with the governor and others on this issue because, again, I mean, this really kind of is out of balance in terms of partisanship or, you know, this is simply common sense and really perhaps more than many issues that confront us really will have a devastating effect on this state. So I'm appreciative of Senator Pogemiller's action on this, and I'm pleased to hear that the governor is trying to work to help resolve this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Lynch, you make me wonder if other swing states are being targeted with these kinds of abrupt changes.
Well, the last election, swing states got extra things. I don't know what's the matter here. I know, but they were given waivers that nobody has been able to get before or since. But so maybe we should kind of pass that along to the governor as he's out there. Maybe he can, instead of getting us our old terms back, get us something better. I don't know. But, you know.
Senator Bergman.
Senator Sharon.
Does anybody have a sense of what I didn't hear this, but I'm trying to think about what are they trying to solve with these actions that they're taking? Is there something at their end that they're seeing this as the solution to, other than sort of looking around and trying to figure out what states are doing that they think might be unnecessary? I mean, are they trying to solve a problem at their end by these kinds of restrictions that reduce our revenue stream by $200 million? Does anybody know what's the problem that's being solved with the solution?
Well, the only thing that I can guess about is that when the SCHIP program was under reauthorization at the federal level, it was the Bush administration's position that parents should not be allowed to be part of the program. And, you know, the whole thing never ended up getting resolved. It just, the program got reauthorized and extended on the same terms that it had been. But, you know, to take that position that you're trying to insert into a reauthorization that wasn't successful and to impose it in the waiver process seems to me a little out of bounds.
And a penalty, especially to Minnesota, where
yes.
we were resolving some of the levels of poverty in our earlier program, so that...
Well, and at least at the federal level, while it wasn't especially desirable, they were taking into account states like Minnesota by trying to say okay. that we could, over time, phase the children in to the SCHIP program. This is taken away... the parents' eligibility and doing nothing to help us with the children. Are there other questions? I think Senator Rosen had a question, but she had to step out, so maybe you'll be around for a few more minutes if she comes back. Okay. Good luck with the efforts that the department is making.
Thank you.
Another issue that I thought as long as we were here today that we would try to get an update about is we all know that the federal government implemented new rules for TANF. There was a new law passed in regard to TANF, and the rules were not promulgated and were not finalized, and now they are. And so I thought we'd just... get a little update on whether we think those rules are going to have any impact one way or the other in terms of the TANF program in Minnesota. And we have Chuck Johnson, the assistant commissioner here, and with him is Steve Nelson.
I'm sorry, I do have a hand.
And while we're getting that handed out, Senator Rosen, did you have a question for Ms. Berg?
No, actually it was, well, either one of you can answer it, Madam Chair. And it was basically they cut the funding off on August 11th, or they allowed the funding to continue to September 24th. So if we are still processing some of this, it is definite that we won't receive a back payment?
My understanding about the way it would work is if we don't accept the conditions that have been outlined by CMS of the new waiver, that the old waiver expired on August 11th.
Okay.
So if we accept the new conditions, those new conditions would apply from August 11th forward. If we don't accept the waiver, then the waiver expired on August 11th. That's my understanding.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I see, too, in the article that there's half a dozen or six other states that are dealing with this also. It'd be interesting to know if the federal delegation is working with them along on those tracks. I mean, we can do what we can here, but they really need to spearhead that.
Well, that is a good point. Good point. Well, we've got handouts.
Madam Chair, Chuck Johnson, Assistant Commissioner of Children and Family Services with the Department of Human Services. I wanted to particularly start by addressing an announced change we don't have regulations on yet related to a provision called excess MOE, excess maintenance of effort. Just to remind the committee what that is, under TANF, we're required to meet work participation rates. If we don't meet that work participation rate in a given year, we can be penalized by losing a portion of our TANF block grant. Excess MOE was something that was created back in the 99 regulations in TANF, but it wasn't sort of, most states weren't aware of how to use it until more recently. What it allows is every year for TANF, we have a maintenance of effort requirement. That for us is $191 million in state money we need to spend on allowable activities for families and kids in order to show that we can get our TANF block grant. If we are also spending money that could be claimed as MOE, that is money that's being spent on human services or income support for families and kids that's beyond that $191 million, excess MOE allows us to claim that money through a very complicated formula. in a way that allows us to reduce the work participation rate that we have to meet as a state. So it's a way for us to essentially use some of the excess spending that we're doing, that as other services we're providing to families who are TANF eligible under the way the federal law is written, to get some credit against the work participation rate and therefore allow us hopefully to avoid being penalized. The excess MOE, piece within the federal regulations came into discussion when the regulations that were put in place after the Deficit Reduction Act in 2006 were being discussed. And at the time, there was some concern that HHS might actually not allow states to use excess MOE in those regulations. In fact, what they did was they, in the regulations, which were interim regulations in June of 2006 and were finalized in February of this year, they actually not only legitimized excess MOE, they actually put out a process for how states go about claiming excess MOE and how essentially to use it. So we used that information, as you're aware, in this very room, to put together a proposal for our ability to access and use this as a way to mitigate the potential loss of TANF through penalties against our work participation rate. And so we did pass a bill sometime actually early in session so we could put our claims through to try to use the excess MOE authority that was there. Much to our surprise and disappointment, in May, the HHS announced that they were going to issue regulations before the end of the year that would eliminate the use of excess MOE. This was just several months after they had actually put in regulation how to use excess MOE and put this process in place for states to use. We are in the process of working with AFSA at the national level. We have briefed the governor's office in D.C. on this issue. They're talking with the delegation. As you heard earlier, Christine Bronson is currently in Washington. This is one of the issues that she has also brought to the delegation. And our concern with this radical change in regulation so quickly after they had just put us in a position to actually start using this. And as you know, it takes, when they make a change, it takes us a while to us to figure out what it is, to bring it through this process here, for us to get it into place and make it work. And this kind of switching back and forth just makes it impossible for us to manage the program in a reasonable way, whatever you may think about the policy value of excess MOE one way or the other. I wanted to, and what the handout does, is gives you an idea of what the impact of this will be based on our understanding of or the possibility that excess MOE may be eliminated via federal regulation before the end of the year. If you look at just to walk you through a little bit to remind you how the work participation rate works, if you look at FFY07, the federal target we have is 50%. That means 50% of our MFIP caseload has to be involved in certain work activities, a certain number of hours a week in the way the feds calculate this rate. We're allowed to offset that by our caseload reduction from 2005. And so we have had a 5.54% caseload reduction since 2005. So we actually use that to offset, which means the adjusted target Minnesota has to meet for 07, which is a year that's already done, of course, is 44.6%. Our actual, this page shows estimates, but for 07, these are actuals because we already submitted them to the feds. Work participation rate for 07 was 28.1, and you can see in bold, then that leaves us with a gap of 16.5%. Excess MOE was essentially the mechanism to use to fill that gap, for us to use the excess MOE to essentially buy that rate down so that we wouldn't have a gap there and we'd be able to meet the work participation rate and thus avoid federal penalties. We were able to submit amended claims, I believe it was in April of this year, which allowed us to exercise the excess MOE option for fiscal year 08. So if you're looking at the spreadsheet here, you can circle fiscal year 08. That's a year we should be able to use the excess MOE and we should be safe in terms of meeting the work participation rate. HHS would not take the amended claims for FFY 07. They said that the point had passed where those claims could be moved through. So we are now sitting potentially with, as you see here, the 16.5% gap on FFY 07. We would have expected by this point to have received a letter from the federal government, which in this case would be a penalty letter telling us that we're in penalty status. We have not yet received that, but we do expect it will come. It could be any day. And then, of course, if they get rid of excess MOE going forward, the years looking out in the future, we also won't have excess MOE to close that gap. You'll see that in 10 and 11, we closed the gap anyway, and that's because of the implementation of the work bonus, which is a program that essentially for MFIT families who exit assistance and are working 24 hours a month, we'll continue to pay them $75 in cash as long as they're working for up to 24 months. That allows us to count those families as part of our work participation rate. So we actually move ourselves through that program initiative out of, hopefully, and these are estimates, but out of potential penalties even without the excess MOE. So the situation where we'd sit right now, assuming we do get a penalty letter for 07 at some time in the near future, we'll have 60 days to prepare a corrective compliance plan. And we can avoid penalty if we're able to reduce our gap by half or more in the next period where they would look at our state, which in this case would be FFY 09. And if you look at FFY 09, you can see the gap is 8 percentage points based on our current estimates, which is just less than half of the 16.5% gap in 07. If these estimates were to hold, we may be able to avoid a penalty for 07 by virtue of our corrective compliance having gotten the rate down to a smaller gap that is less than half of what we saw in 07. That's unknown, but based on the estimates of what we have in place right now in current law, we may be able to avoid a penalty through the corrective compliance procedure. And then with 10 and 11 kicking in the bonus, we wouldn't have an issue looking out into those years. So where we sit right now is possibly looking at a penalty for 07, depending on how we actually end up likely in 09. Until we see the letter, we won't know for sure what the feds are going to look at, but that is our understanding of how it would work.
Assistant Commissioner Johnson, have you been giving any thought to how we might close that 09 gap?
Well, Madam Chair, 09 starts in a couple of weeks.
I understand
that. And so it's going to be very challenging, obviously, to do anything from a policy perspective. We're continuing to work with the counties, the employment and training providers, in terms of providing training and technical assistance, trying to speed up and get the supported work money that the legislature has provided used, which will help offset this somewhat, as a way to do the best that we can going into this next year so we can have our work participation rate be as high as it can and thus our gap to be as small as possible.
Has there been any thought of trying to find a way to enhance that supported work money that we have out there to help solve this problem?
Madam Chair, in the immediate term, I'm not sure how we do that or where we would get the resources from.
Well, I just thought maybe you might be looking at rearranging money that you otherwise have in the program some way.
Madam Chair, we do have some money within the what's called the MFIP Innovation Fund, which was in the consolidated fund that department controls, and we have directed some of that money toward paid work experience as well. So that is one thing that we have done to try to move in that direction. We've also directed some of it toward transportation, which continues to be a huge barrier.
Yeah, we're aware of that also. We've been trying to help address those two issues, yes. But unfortunately, we're in a situation now where last session, in order to meet the budget deficit, we had to use up all of the TANF money. So that is not a resource available to us to help solve this problem at this particular point in time.
I don't think so.
Madam Chair?
But it just seems like a pretty large amount of money hanging over our head to in terms of just trying to get 4% more work participation, that it might be worth examining how we might be able to rearrange existing funding to achieve that goal. Are there other questions? Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Johnson, is the excess MOE number here what the expected penalty from the feds would be in these years if nothing changed? It's hard for me to tell.
Madam Chair and Senator Laurie, no, the excess MOE number isn't related to what the actual penalty would be.
So what
our estimate or our guess is that the penalty would be 5% of the block grant after transfers, which would be something a little bit more than $10 million based on the 07. It goes up over time if you, in multiple years, are not meeting a work participation rate. I believe it's a 2% increment each year that gets added on to that penalty. And that has to be backfilled with state general fund. So in a sense, is in a sense double the size. You both lose the TANF and you have to continue to, your MOE essentially goes up by, in that case, $10 million. You have that much more that you also have to be spending.
And then...
So we would have, just to further clarify here, we would have a $5 million, we would have a 5% potential penalty for 07, which would be $10 million. And then if we're not able to meet, and 08 doesn't count, would it be 5% again in 09, or would it be 7% in 09?
Madam Chair, it would be 7% in 09. It goes 5 for the first instance and then 2 percentage points for each instance after that.
Okay.
And then that's compounded by...
So it really is like 14% in 09.
Yeah.
Of our block.
Because
record.
Of the FFP
right.
implications. And then this is a proposed rule. What is the timing on this? And is this something... I know that this is an issue that states all around the country, I mean, last I heard an update on the work participation rates, we were in better shape than most, largely because of this ability to use the excess MOE. But I'm guessing that there's a lot of states looking at this right now. I'm frankly surprised that CMS... It's just taking these positions on issues across the board. This is...
You would think when there are as many states as there are that are really in recession, and this is, you know, a program that, you know, has a harder time meeting its goals during a recession, that they'd be giving us a little more latitude, not pulling back support from us.
My recollection is also that this work participation rate was recently increased significantly.
The rules were changed about it that make it very difficult for states to meet, because things that we used to do, like work search, used to count as a work activity. Now it only counts for the first 6 weeks. Well, how many people do you know that are out of work right now that are finding a job in 6 weeks? I mean, I just have a friend who, fortunately, after a year and a half of being unemployed, has gotten a job, you know, at about half the salary she got before, but at least she's got a job. So these folks have more difficulty in the workforce than most people. That's one of the reasons why they're relying on this program. And so, you know, to have more rules about work participation and then to not give us any flexibility is hard to understand.
But then on the proposed rule, do we know the timing? Do we know the timing on the proposed rule and when it might be?
Madam Chair and Senator Laurie, we expect by the end of the year. That was the nature of the announcement. The end of the calendar year.
And so we are in the comment period currently?
The rule has not been issued yet. There was a notice of proposed rulemaking that was issued in August, and there was actually an advance notice in May that I'd never seen anything like before to sort of give us a heads up that this was coming in August. So we haven't actually seen the regulations yet, although the statement in what we have seen is eliminate excess MOE as an option for claiming. So it's probably fairly straightforward as to what the regulation would do. But we have to see it to know for sure.
Mm-hmm. And have we sent official communications to CMS and our federal partners explaining what this would mean?
Madam Chair and Senator Laurie, I'm not sure that we've sent a letter yet. By October 6th is when they were looking for a response, and we are working on that.
This is a little premature, but I thought as long as we were here, you know, that we would want to know about this too. Assistant Commissioner, is it typical for them to propose a rule and finalize it that would sort of be retroactive?
Madam Chair, it's not typical, and we're certainly hoping that would not
because,
be the case here.
I mean, if the rule isn't finalized until the end of the year, clearly half of fiscal year 09 is over.
Right.
And, you know, why wouldn't we be able to claim excess MOE during fiscal year 09 then?
Madam Chair, I'm guessing that they would base it around when the when those claiming reports would normally be due, and I'm turning to Steve if he has any additional thoughts on what the timing might look like.
Maybe due December 31st.
Those reports are normally due December 1st. 31st, I'm sorry. So if they got the regulation out before then, it would be possible they could it could be effective then.
Well, I guess they want to keep themselves busy, don't they, right to the end? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Johnson. And maybe other people are following this better than I am, but in just in terms of the math, exactly in dollars, how large a budget hole are we talking about in our state budget as a result of this change, assuming it goes into effect?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, we believe the TANF penalty could potentially be $10 million, slightly above that. And the requirement on that would be that we also, the requirement when you take the penalties, you also have to then backfill that amount with state dollars. And so that would be another $10 million.
So it would be $20 million for 07, but then it would be 4% more in 09.
Madam Chair, Steve suggested to me the way that actually works is if we were not penalized in 08 because of the excess MOE, 09 would be looked at again as a new first year, and so it would be another
That's
5%.
That's what I just asked. That's what I was wondering.
I'm sorry. So it would actually be $10 million again.
Okay.
And then we'd start again toward the possibility of ratcheting back up if future years came in below target.
Okay. So the $10 million would happen again in 09 potentially with a total impact of $20
million. Right. And Madam Chair, Steve also had another piece that I wanted him to come up and address that was in the rider that for clarification, understand what we already do have in the rider around this.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Steve Nelson. I'm budget director of Children and Family Services. You asked earlier the question, the issue of covering the loss in TANF funds with more maintenance of effort. And if we were penalized and we weren't able to get penalty relief through our corrective compliance plan in 2009, we would get a reduction in our TANF grant the next federal fiscal year of the penalty amount, which right now looks like about $10 million. And we would have to replace that with additional maintenance of effort. And that way there's basically the same amount of money available to the program from a federal standpoint. We do have the opportunity to replace that money with MOE that we would have available because we wouldn't be able to use excess MOE anymore. So it could be just a matter of repositioning funds in order to accommodate the MOE side of that penalty. And so the rider that we passed that includes the excess MOE provision does allow us to make that repositioning of funds. So what would happen is that if we did get a $10 million penalty, the loss to the state would be that $10 million, and then we should be able to find the $10 million in MOE backfill from the sources of MOE that we identified during our excess MOE process.
But when we identified the excess MOE, we're spending it on other things today. So would we have to cut those and move that money? Or would we have to take $10 million out of our TANF spending?
Madam Chair, we wouldn't have to cut those things. We could just claim that other state spending as maintenance of effort, but we would have $10 million less in TANF to spend.
So either we have to replace that or we have to cut the TANF program by $10 million and somehow figure out how to keep meeting our work participation rate in the future.
That's right.
Are there other questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Coring and I were just sharing a lighter moment, and as much as I think we enjoy in our privilege to serve in the Minnesota State Senate, somebody needs to go to Washington.
I would volunteer.
I mean, this would affect more than six other states. I mean, this change, I'm sure, is affecting a lot of other states. So, you know, maybe it's possible that enough opposition can be generated to this rule that it won't get promulgated by December 31st.
Let's hurry up and do it now.
That would be my only thought about this, because it isn't really a secret that there are a lot of states having budget deficits right now, and the future of all the states is really a big question mark with all the things that are going on at the federal level in terms of various financial organizations going under. And these kinds of things that affect our budgets that really are not within our control really just are salt on the wounds, so to speak. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I think you make a good point there, and it's important, you know, in all of our communities, you know, our counties, in our cities, in our school districts are setting their levy limits right now, and I think it's important that we have these kind of discussions so that we can more clearly articulate that, you know, some of these issues that we're talking about today are not issues that are coming to us from legislation passed in Minnesota. They're not coming to us. We're reacting to what has been handed to us, and it's really the more that we can do to articulate that and to communicate that, I think is really important, because as much as we like to think that we are policymakers and we define the parameters, what we're discussing today is far from that.
Senator Coring?
Madam Chair, can I just take a minute or so just to give you my thoughts. You know, as I've this summer and now into the fall been continuously talking to my constituents and talking to county boards and city councils and so on, and school boards, I've been warning them that we're headed for some difficult times ahead, and I think we all know that. And I think all of our constituents are probably about the same as mine. They're right on the edge, and I just think that we need to, when we get our minds prepared to come into this next session, you know, I've said this before, all the pots of money are gone. The tobacco endowment fund and all the little pots of money. The rainy day fund is virtually gone, and the tough work will begin. And so I guess
we did $172 million worth of tough work already.
Right. But what I'm just saying is I'm giving you my speech that I give to my local people. That you know, I'm not looking forward to next session because it's going to be very difficult. There's going to be a lot of decisions that we're not going to like that we're going to have to make. So, you know, and if you look at Fannie Mae and the things that are happening, things are not good, and it's not going to get any better anytime soon.
Well, other questions, Senator Sharon? I want to make sure everybody here has enough information on these two topics so that you feel like you can communicate with your federal elected officials about this.
I'll formulate this in a question. It's really rhetorical. It's not a question, but playing off of what Senator Coring said, that it's the same question I had from the last discussion. What is the context, or I try to understand the motivation, what problem is trying to be solved by these changes that are being made that are impacting us at the state level? I know that my local communities, my counties and my cities and school districts are really frustrated with cost shifting, where they have to create, they still have the problem, they even have mandates and obligations to meet, and we're not able to provide the same state support with the revenue stream that we have. And so that context creates problems for everybody, and I understand that. But I don't see the context coming from the federal government. They're not saying, either for the last discussion we had or this one, what is the problem they're trying to solve by shifting this and changing these regulations and creating these financial crises at the state level when we're already in a great deal of difficulty at the state level. And I just don't hear any explanation for that. It helps me try to figure out, if not this, then what? I mean, we can be partners in trying to create solutions, but not if they're simply doing something and it doesn't come out of any context that provides an adequate explanation for this action.
I don't think there is any explanation for this, as we were told they just finished promulgating a rule in May that allows us to do this, and we're following that rule, and, you know, yet somehow they're trying to promulgate another rule by the end of the year that would be in the opposite direction. It doesn't make any sense. I think it's just purely a financial move on their part. Senator Rosen?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And what's a little more frustrating is, as it says, the proposed rule is silent on the effective date of the change. So they're throwing this out there, and who knows what's going to happen. And the 1st of November, as far as an election, it's very confusing, this one. I don't understand this at all.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much, and good luck on trying to get this one worked through as well. We have some other people that wanted to testify about these TANF rules, and so I called on Deborah Schlick and Jennifer Johnson.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm with the Affirmative Options Coalition. We're a coalition of more than 50 organizations that, among other things, try to advocate for an effective welfare-to-work program. Ms. Johnson will testify after I do. I will be brief. We know you've been sitting here and getting bad news after bad news. What we'd like to do for a couple of minutes is explain what sounds very arcane, excess MOE, work participation rates, promulgation of rules, and let you know that it creates a budget headache and challenge for you, but it has very direct impact on the work that Minnesota and the people you've asked to do that work are trying to do, helping very poor families with very poor children get work and move out of poverty. So that's the intent of our testimony. So to explain a couple things in summary quickly, and perhaps starting with Senator Sharon's question about context, what is going on in TANF really began as part of the 2005 Deficit Reduction Act. And TANF policy was slipped into that act very late in the game, December 18th. And I believe Senator Berglund was talking about CMS rules in the dark of night, literally pre-dawn hours in some congressional discussion. And what Congress did, ended up doing in the Deficit Reduction Act, was change the formula by which it measures state performance in the welfare-to-work programs. The Congressional Research Services, which works for Congress, analyzed those formula changes and reported back that under those changes, 47 out of the 50 states would fail to hit their performance targets. Instead of being information to take that out of the bill, that was information that allowed it to stay in the bill. Because in a budget reconciliation bill under congressional rules, you can only have policy language that has significant fiscal impact. The significant fiscal impact was the likelihood that the federal government could rely on the probability it would be penalizing 47 out of 50 states, reducing their TANF block grants, and recognizing a savings on the federal budget. From where my members sit in our coalition, who think it really matters to help very poor families and their children move out of poverty, that seems very cynical policymaking. And but it is what we're dealing with today. It's what we've been dealing with now for a couple of years. So the authority in some of those changes was the authority to Health and Human Services to deal with some issues in TANF through regulation. The regulation that is less visible to you, but is visible every single day as families approach their local employment service counseling agencies and their local counties to get help getting work, are the rules that HHS issued that told states what activities can count as work. And by the way, we get no credit for getting someone a job who gets them off welfare. This work participation rate is all about measuring what people still on welfare are doing and what the federal government recognizes as a work activity, not what perhaps an experienced employment counselor knows will move this person into work. So what the rules the program's operating under are rules that tell the staff how they have to verify activities and how they have to document activities. We asked the graduate program at the Humphrey Institute last spring to do a study for us to understand how much has this documentation and verification taken over sort of the work of the system. And the handout you received, it's probably down in your pile, their findings after tracking counselors in six different organizations in both metro and non-metro spots in Minnesota is that employment counselors now spending more than half their time on documentation and verification, leaving less than half their time to do the things that solve problems, that help people get work and stay in work. And a reminder that you already had in the welfare system a staff person in the county office, the eligibility worker, whose full-time job was the collection of paper, of verifying information, and that the job counselor, as welfare reform was launched, was going to be the worker who engages with the person and focuses on results. So now we really have one and a half workers spending most of their time. Ms. Johnson is going to just tell you, as an employment counselor who works in southeastern Minnesota, what the job looks like these days, and so what that means for the families who are turning to the program.
Thank you. Today I consider myself to be very lucky. Today I left work and I was able to tell my coworkers where I was going and what I was doing. When I attend off-site meetings, I'm being trusted that I will do what I'm saying that I'm doing. If I were on assistance right now, I would have to document all my time here. When I got to this meeting, I would have to ask a responsible adult to sign off on the time I arrived and the time that I left, because I'm not trusted that I said I would be where I was. When I left my office, my clients who are job searching, they had to be in job search class at 9:30. They will sign in, and they have a weekly job log, and the person teaching class has to sign off on that and make sure it's turned in every week, because we have to prove they were actually at that location. Before or after class, if they use our resource room that has computers, they need to ask someone there to sign in the time that they came in and the time that they left to verify whether or not they were actually doing their job search activities. They have to list every internet site that they use, every employer that they go to. They will need to list who they talked to, how long they were there, and what the results of that activity were. 10 years ago when I started this job, I could approve a school plan for a client and trust that they were attending school based on their attendance and their grades. Now when someone is in school, I have to have them request when they go into the computer lab that someone sign off on the time that they come in, someone has to sign off on the time that they left to prove to me that they're studying. In the way that the rules are written, it also says that the instructor of that class must sign that they were actually there every day. I can't just trust that when they get straight A's, they did as they said they were doing. Under MFIP, I reviewed someone's time logs. I spent half an hour documenting a month and a half of her time with study time and her school time. It took me 30 minutes of time that I could have spent with her, listening to her life, to document whether or not she was doing that and recording into my system, and also making sure I case noted. If I missed one of those steps and there's an audit, I would have been in error, and then those hours would not be considered as complying. Also, her first year of school counts. Any schooling after that, I can approve up to a two-year plan. Her second year of schooling does not count towards the rates that they had been talking about, so those would be considered as not meeting compliance. At the first intake, I used to get to really know people, and I feel like now at my first appointment, we talk about job logs. How do you report everything? What do you write down? When do you turn it in? What happens if you don't turn it in? It seems like every time a client comes to see me, I have to tell them what activities they have to do, and I feel like I'm telling them, you just walked in today, but already I'm sending a message to them. I don't trust that you're going to tell me the truth, and I feel like that's really taken away from them being able to be comfortable in talking with me. On Mondays, I'm greeted with a pile of job logs of anyone who's job searching or maybe not working enough that needs to document more. It takes about 2.5 minutes to 10 minutes to review each log to make sure that it's accurate. If anything's missing, it's considered incomplete, and we have to request that that individual comes back and completes it. I will also then have to case note the job log, and I have to track it into the system. Again, if that were audited, any step I missed, the client would not get credit for what they had done. We are also required to have them sign off, have a responsible adult sign off on everything. If the client were attending AA meetings, the way the rules are written, we would have to ask that someone sign off on that. We at this time, we don't feel comfortable pressing that at all, because at AA meetings, everyone should be treated with confidentiality. There's some things that we just do not feel, even though they are in the rules, that are appropriate for us to reinforce. During this past week, I worked with a young mom who has two children. Right now, we have used her 6 weeks of job search. She, I feel, is still not work ready, but we don't have any documentation to change her program. I want to sit down and talk to her about how is it going finding an affordable place to live? How is all the stress with your family? She's upset. There's so many things going on. But I have to instead, at the end of the time, discuss, here's your last 2 weeks of job logs. These were not filled out complete. She has two children, doesn't know where she's going to live, and I have to talk to her about, why did you not write the name of the person that you talked to into this position? Today she called me right before I left my office. We talked about what time to set your alarm at. She did that. She did everything I asked her. She moved up to an hour earlier bus. She did everything I had talked to her about. She needed to be in my job search class today at 9:30 to get credit. She couldn't because it took over an hour to get across town, and she could not get to the class in time at 9:30 today. To me, she was a huge success. She did all the goals that we set. On paper, she would be considered not meeting compliance, and I will not get credit for her today, even though she's done above and beyond what I wanted her to. And when she comes in, I don't get to talk to her. I have to go over job logs, and I just feel like I'm not doing her the service that I should. Also, we have an amazing relationship with the GED Center in Rochester, and they do a great job tracking. They follow up with individuals, and we have a few individuals who are working on their GEDs right now. Those activities, once they're over the age of 20, are no longer considered core hours. Those would be the hours they were just talking about with work participation rates. We have to choose between what is best for that person. Is it getting their GED full-time right now, or is it to find a way to get them into a job to work towards work participation rate? What we found a lot of times is individuals who may have been going to the GED center and working really hard, if they start working, they may work 40 hours per week, they may be a single parent, and they don't have time to come back and finish their GED. So we're torn between doing the right thing. At times, we, as employment counselors, we feel like doing a good job complying with all the federal guidelines, we are losing our ability to advocate for the clients. The time I'm spent double-checking and verifying and documenting is taking away the time that I can make a difference in someone's life. When I've done resumes with participants, I've always been shocked at the difference it's made. When I type up their work history and their skills, it seems like they're a completely different person. They seem to have new confidence, and they're just glowing when they leave my office. I can guarantee you that as I do a job log with someone and talk about how to fill out a job log right, I've never changed their attitude positively. And I want to do more resumes, but in order to do that, I would take away from the rules that are expected. I never chose to work in social services because I'm good at math. So math may take me longer than some other people. And as the rules continue to change, career counselors are finding themselves with less time to help clients become successful and more time tracking and monitoring. And I'm not saying that there should be no rules. I just feel like at this point I've reached a point where the rules have become a barrier, that I'm a barrier to helping them succeed.
Thank you. Are there questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. It seems like we hear this kind of testimony in other committees as well. Education, nurses are stuck in the same trap. Long-term care providers, the same thing. So much of their time is spent documenting the services given diminish. And actually, yesterday, just down in Rochester, I know Senator Lynch was there, there was a huge educational conference going on, and it was about response to intervention, dealing with the same process flaw. And that is, we get into documenting so much of what we're doing that what we're doing completely falls off the radar as far as, you know, that's the outcome. We should be measuring outcomes, and we should be much more focused on providing more services. The context yesterday was special education, and we heard over and over the same sort of thing. Rather than giving the intervention needed to the student, the time was spent on graphs and charts and documentation, and there seems to be a huge awareness amongst the people who do the daily work that this is not working, and we need to move to a different model. And so I'm really encouraged that education community is really talking about that. We need to continue to talk about that in the healthcare community as well.
Other questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a comment, I want to thank Ms. Schlick and Ms. Johnson for coming and joining us today. And members, I'm one of those families. 32 days ago, my husband lost his job. And everything that Ms. Johnson said is true. And reading is to students like jobs are to families. And whether we serve in this committee or any other committee, economic development or education, whatever it is, we should be doing everything that we can to make it easy to help Minnesotans find jobs. It shouldn't be a barrier. I have a new appreciation for the work that you do and the reality, because it's very real. And I will tell you, my husband and I are both, we are educated people. We have a lot going for us, we think. And it's difficult. And my heart goes out to those that are not as fortunate as we have been. It's very difficult. So thank you for the work that you do, and I hope that we'll remember this as we move forward and are asked to implement and articulate policy.
Well, you know, what strikes me is that, you know, these rules are bad enough. But the fact that you actually are doing what you're supposed to do and you don't get credit for it so that it looks like you're not meeting your work participation rate when maybe it's just a matter of, you know, somebody else was supposed to sign something and they didn't do it. And they don't probably realize how important signing that something is. I mean, I remember when my daughter was in school and she had a 504 plan and the teachers were never doing what they were supposed to do according to the 504 plan, and it was impossible to get them to do it regularly and consistently. And it sounds a little bit like that is what's going on here, you know. You ask somebody if they'll sign something, and they say, yeah, I'll do it in a minute, and then the minute goes by, and they forgot that they were supposed to sign it. They didn't sign it, and you've got to go because your bus is coming, and if you miss your bus, you'll miss your next thing. And so the whole thing sounds to me like it's a catch-22 that's being laid on people. You know, that it's like inventing systems that people will fail even if they're doing what they're supposed to do. And I just think that's a terrible way for this program to be run.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Perhaps you could give a little historical aspect of this because obviously these rules have been made because maybe there has been some slippage or abuse of the system, or has it always been like this, and or do they keep ramping up these rules? Can you address that? And I have another question after this too.
Well, just for a little historical context, to be fair, this was a block grant program given to the states, and you know, as opposed to the old days where if we were going into a recession and we had more people who were unemployed and were on assistance, we got more federal help. Okay. So this was a block grant, and it was a block grant that was set, I might say, at a time in history when things were going fairly well financially in the United States of America. So the caseloads weren't particularly high, and the states were told, you take this money, and you have to make your grants with it, and you have to get people back to work. And you can have all the flexibility in the world to do that. But as the program went on, sort of each and every year, more and more expectations of what we have to do were tied to that. Mm-hmm. And then when the reauthorization came along, I mean, you can be doing the best job in the world of getting people jobs and getting them off the program. And remember, for many families, 24 hours a month of work is going to get you off the program. But then you don't get to count that. Those people don't count. It's only the people left in the program and what they're doing that counts. And so in a way, the new way of doing things in Washington regarding this program makes me believe that they weren't interested in getting people off of welfare and to work. Because that's what we were trying to do originally. And now it's, you know, it would appear to the public that don't know better that the program fails. Mm-hmm. Because the people that haven't found a job are not meeting what the expectations of the program are. And yet they take away things that any person with any common sense would say make sense, like work search. Only count work search for 6 weeks. You haven't found a job yet? Well, obviously you still need to be in work search, but that doesn't count. You have to be doing something else to meet the widget that they're going to count. And so, to me, it's gone from a program with some flexibility at the state level and goals of moving people from welfare to work to a program that's set up and destined for people to fail.
Madam Chair. My other question is to Ms. Johnson. You mentioned this woman, or mother, who is trying, and you mentioned trying to get her to be work ready. What is your definition of work ready?
Thank you, Senator. A lot of our clients are coming in right now with, they don't have housing, and I just don't know how I can expect someone to go to a job every day when they don't know where they're going to live in a few more weeks. I need to help her find stable housing. A lot of mine also just don't have the skills right now to work. We've had a lot of issues with attendance and being on time, sometimes attitude. A lot of mine, if you talk to them and, you know, you don't have that second rate available, the way they react, sometimes they'll yell back at you. And, you know, I need to build trust to get her, to get to a point where I can talk to her and be like, these are the appropriate things to do at work. And I feel like I used to be able to do some of those things. But right now it's all documentation, and she'll never let me try to get in, I feel like, to be able to help with those. Right now, I think in the last few days, I've had at least 5 people who are considered homeless. And I just, how do you even find daycare if you don't know what area of town you're going to live in? And most of them are using the bus line, which in Rochester you may think it's not that difficult, but it could take them 2 hours to get to me based on all those things. And sometimes it's just a feeling I have, but it's a lot of soft skills. Or maybe I'd like to even be able to have them do computer classes or work on those, their GED. And those hours do not count towards work participation in most of the cases.
Other questions?
Madam Chair, has there ever been any studies done that measure how many actual dollars that the clients, do you call them clients or residents or
clients, participants,
that the participants actually get in actual dollars versus the number of dollars spent in the system trying to get them to work?
Well, I think it'd be a new study that we need to do now if we ever did it.
It just seems to me, as we listen to the testimony here and the other gentlemen that have been at the table here talking about, all the rules and the caseload target reduction credits and people looking at the books and then not only at the state level but the federal level and deciding whether we as a state have met every little loophole that they had have us jumping through. You know, if you take all the energy in the system, in the bureaucracy, and try to help out actual people on the ground, whether the poverty issues with families or work-related issues, you know, we could be getting a lot better outcomes shifting from, it seems to me we're spending a massive amount of money in the system, you know, pointing fingers and double-checking that everybody's doing what they're doing instead of just giving them the money to go out and get a job.
Chairman Berglund, Senator Ropes, I would guess with DHS numbers you could see how much money is spent on the MFIP grants and then other activities, and you'll find that most of the TANF block grant is not spent on the income support that the families receive. But that is part of why we did our study. These are very tough times to ask you to spend more money on the program. So it does seem that if the federal government's sending us a block grant, that we have to spend it in this way seems a loss of resources, just as though it were a cut. And I want to go back to the piece that a number of you alluded to in the question that Senator Sharon asked just before I testified, which these rules are new. And we do not... As we watch where the policy started and where the rules ended up, we don't see an accident. Because remember, they started in a Congress that was trying to figure out how to cut federal spending. So these rules, the rules you heard testimony about excess MOE, all have the genesis in the same place. What's the likelihood states will not meet their performance targets and the federal government can collect some of the TANF block grant back? So we don't experience these rules as sort of the accident over time of creeping bureaucracy, but as a way to really put very poor families and their children in the middle of a power struggle between the states and the federal government about who gets what dollars in their budget.
Thank you. Other questions, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, this discussion reminds me of a presentation that I had yesterday at a county board meeting. And the approach the county board was taking was to talk more in general about human services dollars coming from the state to the county. And basically the message that they were conveying was, we have enough dollars in the system. The problem is we need more measurement, more outcome-based payments of those dollars, and more accountability, which sounds good. You know, we all like to know that we're spending our money in a way that you know, brings results. But I think the message was deliberately one that somehow we're wasting money in paying for these programs, are wasting money within the system. Although when I asked specifically for examples of programs that weren't working or things they would suggest we could cut, I didn't get any feedback along that line. But again, it seemed to be, and I agree, I don't think it was an accident. It seems to me an overall philosophy that we're trying to deliver to the public that somehow there's so much money being wasted, but it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you set up all the money going into tracking and documenting, you don't have the money for the services, then they look as though they're not working, they're failing, and then you can justify taking the money away. So, I mean, I really think we have to be careful that there's a fine line there. We don't want to waste money, certainly, but are we really doing this for the right reasons, and really what is our ultimate goal?
Well, it's one of the reasons we were trying to put some more money into supported work, so when a person loses their 6 weeks of work search, that they could have something that they were doing that would meet the work participation rate while they still look for a job. Yes. And that sometimes those supported work jobs turn into, you know, real paid jobs. It's pretty hard to be using the program to balance a budget and be doing everything we've done with the program in the past. I mean, you know, some of this money is used for things that don't exactly directly relate to the MFIP TANF goals, like, you know, there's some of this money that goes into home visiting. You know, if we lose money in our TANF block grant, you know, do we have to visit things like that? Mm-hmm. You know, because obviously you can't cut anything that actually is helping somebody meet the requirements of the program, because if you do, you'll be worse off in terms of the next year. So I don't know, but I do know that I think there are people that are meeting the requirements that are not getting credit for it, and we're not getting credit for it. I know that if you're 2 minutes late for work, they don't dock you a whole day's pay. Any other questions? Well, if not, I hope you'll be sending your letters off to people on this issue as well. And with that, I will thank you for your good attendance today. The meeting's adjourned.
It's the question, but okay. I want to talk to her too, because I sent her a copy of this thing from the county.